Well, hello all, and welcome to our fifth class. So hopefully you have actually listened to all four classes preceding this by now and had a chance to at least try some of the content. This is our midway check-in. We are halfway through the curriculum. And what's interesting is that even after just four classes, I really believe that the essential content that we need to know and apply is over and done with. It's all been presented. And the reason that I say that is you can read a lot of nutrition books, and you can take a lot of different courses and learn a tremendous amount of information, and the practical reality is it never gets applied, or very little of it gets applied. And most classes suffer from this sort of information overwhelm problem, when the real truth of the matter is that what we all need to do to make a profound difference in our lives is incredibly simple. So with the way that we eat, with the way that we move, with basic lifestyle variables, 75-80% of what we need is really simple, and it can be covered in around 3 or 4 hours of discussion. And the challenge that occurs for most of us is in actually practically applying the simple amount of information that we get on a day-by-day basis. So normally, as we confront that practical challenge, the solutions that occur to us take various forms, like create a system. Like, I know I want to exercise. So let me create a system. Let me, you know, put it in my schedule and make sure that I get to the gym. Or I know that I want to eat better, so let me institute this healthy food system, or let me keep junk food out of the house. You know, let me sort of try some strategy here and there. And all that stuff can be reasonably effective, but one of the things that we got into in class four is this idea of, you know, really the mental component of health and fitness, the mental component of wellness. It's the most important, it's the most profound, it's the gateway. On the one hand, because it's how we relate to health, fitness, and wellness mentally that gives us what you could call the motivation or the inspiration to actually take the right actions. But then also, interestingly, the mental side of health and wellness directly and profoundly impacts the physical body. So in this class, rather than continue to introduce progressively more sophisticated ideas about nutrition and exercise and supplementation, which frankly most people are never going to apply, my real focus is on providing everything possible that enables all of us to take these really simple steps that will make a difference based on the information that's already been presented. Now that said, class 6, 7, 8, and 9 is new information. And we're going to look at things like detox, and we're going to do a class on supplementation. We're going to get some more stuff. But that's the icing on the cake. And in fact, I believe that the real value of those final four classes is they're more specific, and they're ways for you to take some concrete action steps. But my hope from those classes is that you'll apply the content and experience positive results, which will motivate you and get you to actually really apply and live for months to come the content from the first four classes. Because it's the content from the first four classes that's the simple stuff that we need to apply every day, and it's the everyday application over time that makes a profound difference in the body. So I believe I mentioned this analogy once before when I was talking a little bit about functional breathing mechanics, but it's a really great analogy to keep in mind. If you listening live right now or listening via MP3, if you take your fingers and reach in your mouth and grab your back molar on either side, grab one of your top back molars, like actually do this, it's an interesting little experiment, and try to jiggle your molar. So actually try to jiggle your molar back and forth and see if you can move that back molar, that really big tooth, with your hand. And if you try to do it, you'll feel that that molar, it's very stable. It's not easy to move it. And it's interesting because with that jiggling action that you're moving back and forth, you're exerting probably around 8 or 9 pounds of pressure on your molar. So that's probably about how hard you're pushing if you're really pushing. You're probably not pushing harder than that. And that 8 or 9 pounds of pressure doesn't move your tooth at all. Well, if you go to the dentist and you get braces, and you wear braces for 6 months, in 6 months, those braces will move your teeth. They'll move your molars. And so an interesting question is how much force do braces exert? Because the way they work, right, is you cement those little brackets to your teeth, and then you run a wire through the braces, and the wire is twisted to create tension. And then it's the tension in that wire that actually moves your teeth. So it's interesting. Take a moment and actually guess how much force has to be exerted through that wire to move your teeth. And the answer is 1 gram. 1 gram of force. That's about 1/350th of a pound. It's like you know, a single pin, like a push pin that you push into a calendar, weighs more than a gram. Virtually nothing. But the consistent application of that force over time can move a molar. So wellness practices like that. It's about the slow and steady and gradual application of something impactful, of something meaningful over time. And that formula, that's the one of the two core theses of our class, the MEDS formula, mind state, exercise, diet, sleep, that those are the core four elements in transforming your body and moving you towards health and wellness. It's the application of the subtle but profound changes over time that transforms you. So the eating 80 to 90% whole foods most of the time, except when you're on vacation and on special events like Christmas and your birthday. It's the doing consistent movement. You know, if you're not doing anything, it's the walking 20 minutes, 3 times a week, and really making it a priority and doing what you have to do to make this happen. You put it in the calendar, you listen to music, whatever. It's these simple and subtle changes applied consistently over a period of time that profoundly changes you. And things simple like breathing mechanics and like meditation. And this part that's so interesting about all this is that it almost doesn't matter which sphere of lifestyle transformation you take on. It just matters that you take on something and that you make it habitual so that you can exert that 1 gram of pressure consistently. And to do that, you have to feel good about it. You have to feel comfortable about the change. You have to feel inspired about the result that you expect. You have to feel motivated. You have to feel great about it. So at this point, as we do our midway check-in on this course, all of you have participated to various degrees. There's one participant who's been on every call. There are some participants who I know have listened to every call. Some of you have listened to a couple calls. Maybe you're not listening to this call, except I'm going to email all of you and badger you and make sure you tune into this call. Wherever you are in this course to date, you are where you are. And I want you to take a moment and look back at the last month since you committed to being a part of this. And if you haven't participated the way that you want to, you will encounter a bunch of reasons for that. You'll look and you'll see I was too busy, or I didn't want to take this on, or maybe you didn't like one of the concepts. What I want to say is all that's fine. It's all well and good. Also, if you've participated to any extent, you've picked up a couple things that sounded appealing to you, that seem meaningful, that you believe you could apply, which you may not have done. So what I'm going to say to you now is apply those things and don't worry about the rest. So mind state, exercise, diet, sleep. It is a recipe for life transformation. I'm actually putting a book together right now, and the title is something like The Sure and Simple Path to Health, Happiness, and a Life of Purpose. And what that book asserts is that if you bring the way that you eat, the way that you move, your lifestyle, nutrition, etc., and of course also your mind state into harmony with your design, meaning that you eat, move, sleep, live, and think the way that your mind, body, and spirit are designed, eat, move, sleep, live, and think, it will work. You will become more healthy. You'll become happier. You'll succeed more easily, and you'll begin to feel your life imbued with greater purpose. And this is a certainty. This is a fundamental and eternal truism. The potential in each individual may seem different in time, whereas one person makes changes and loses more weight or gets more productive or whatever. But everyone, if they follow these formulas, you'll get somewhere. The barrier is taking it on in your life, and that's a real barrier. And it's a barrier that's presented by where you're at mentally and emotionally. So if you look back through your life, you'll see a whole bunch of reasons why maybe you haven't taken on the things that inspired you. What I'm going to say to you right now is do the stuff that inspires you and only do that. Don't try to take on more. So you've gotten a reasonable amount of information from our talk thus far. You've gotten a reasonable amount of content, and you've gotten some practical tips that you can apply. Practical tips that sound like practice breathing 5 minutes 3 times a week, or go for a walk 20 minutes 3 times a week. Simple, simple, simple stuff. Or do cardio and do it in intervals. Follow the programs I sent out. You've got a recipe. All you got to do is tape them on a machine and do them. And one of the things that those programs encourage you to do is don't exert yourself too much. If you don't feel good doing it, you're pushing too hard. Do it in a way that feels good. Or there's a cooking system. Try making some beans and grains and combining them in different recipes. So many different dimensions. Take on something. Create space for it in your life. And take on the thing that you feel best taking on, not the thing that you think you need to change, not the thing that you think you should do. Take on the thing that you feel best taking on. Because the thing that you feel best taking on, you're most likely to do. And that practice will become like braces. It'll become this slow and steady, consistent force that gradually begins to transform your body and maybe transforms your life. And that's the key. And then just be present to the way that it's making you feel. And that's everything, the way that it's making you feel physically, mentally, and emotionally. So whatever you take on, if you aren't consistently feeling better doing it, it's not working. You should be feeling a little bit more peaceful, a little bit more confident, a little bit more healthy, a little bit more energized, a little bit more inspired, a little bit more something that feels good. And that's the access. That's the key. That's what's going to keep you motivated. That's what's going to keep you applying what you're doing. So at this point, it definitely behooves us to talk about the whole issue of wellness guilt. It's a big phenomenon in our culture, health and wellness guilt. We have like this very shame-based relationship with health and wellness practices. And probably if you're looking back over the last month, and you're saying to yourself, I did get what Vaughn is talking about. It kind of makes sense, and I sort of know I should exercise more, and I realize that I didn't make time for it, and I know I should eat better, and I don't. There's some sort of emotional uneasiness surrounding this, perhaps with a level of denial. If it occurs to you like, yeah, I know that, but I don't care, that's denial. If you feel a little bit numb about it, it's denial. Or maybe you're actually present to the fact that you feel like a little bit guilty or a little ashamed or whatever. All of this is a consequence of this strange, strange culture that we live in that sort of makes us feel like being healthy is like some obligations that we're not overweight, which is morally bad, and maybe it's that we don't cost the healthcare system money, which is like morally bad. Very strange. And this is also the reason behind the French paradox. This is why French people eat more calories than we do, drink wine, eat cheese, eat chocolate, eat carbs, and don't get fat. They do it without guilt. Like the emotional impact of guilt is tremendous. So whatever has stopped you from taking on the practices in this course that you know would make a difference, you know what? That's what stopped you. And it's fine. And it's natural. And it is all part of the transformation that we're talking about here. Because the fact of the matter is, what it takes on the knowledge and action level to transform your life and get super healthy is simple. It is incredibly simple, and it's not hard. It's straightforward. Eat the way your body's built, move the way your body's built, live the way your body's built, and think and feel and deal with your emotions the way that your mind, soul, spirit, whatever is built. It's that simple, and then you just got to learn these basic principles about how all this stuff is built, and it's really not that complicated. And when you live in harmony with that, the total system works. So it's simple. But simple doesn't mean easy. Simple and easy are so completely different. I like to make the analogy with golf. Golf is a simple game. All it takes to be a good golfer is you just have to hit the ball straight where you point it. Unbelievably simple. And then even the mechanics of how you do that are simple. It's just about, you know, hips and wrists and body rotation and timing, and that's it. And if you bring it together, you're home, and you can be a good golfer. But realistically, in order to gain that skill set, that physical skill set, it's going to take time, it's going to take consistency, and you have to be gentle with yourself, and you have to be forgiving. And so if you want to improve as a golfer, you go out, and on the first day, you don't expect yourself to be able to, you know, shoot near par and hit the ball straight every time. You realize you're going to mess up a lot. And then you continue to practice, and your shots start to get a little bit straighter, and some days are better, and some days are worse. And if you have a healthy relationship with golf, when you don't put up a good number, you don't beat yourself up. You don't walk away saying, I played like crap and I should have done better and blah, blah, blah. You say, well, I kind of get my shot was a little off today. What was going on? You know, maybe my wrists were off. Maybe I was rotating wrong. Maybe my foot was wrong. Maybe I can use this as an opportunity to learn. That's a healthy relationship. Unhealthy relationship is as you're beginning or as you're just beginning to get better, you go one of two ways. you don't do as well as you hope, and you say to yourself, well, that sucked, and I'm crap, and I need to do better, and I should do better, and you bury yourself in some form of guilt or shame. Equally unhealthy is to get driven. Well, damn it, I'm going to get this right. I'm going to push myself, and I'm going to work harder, and that's unacceptable, and I'm going to do better. Equally unhealthy, maybe worse. That's a person cruising for a nervous breakdown. And I make this analogy in the wake of what happened with Tiger Woods, without any moral judgment of Tiger Woods, but you may notice this consistent pattern in our culture of these extremely successful people, sometimes at the height of their success and fame, having these violent breakdowns where there's affairs or drug use or alcohol or their lives fall apart. I mean, it happened with the President of the United States to a certain extent. It's happened with so many movie stars and so many actors and musicians. This isn't a coincidence. When you get yourself into a certain position through self-tyranny and emotional violence, you're going to violently decompensate. The results that you get are never going to satisfy you. And it's maybe even more destructive to be driven to succeed than to be defeatist. Healthy relationship with any kind of achievement in life, in sports, in politics, in money, with your body, any kind of a situation. A healthy relationship with it is, I am where I am. And I expect to make slow and consistent progress, and I do not judge myself, and I don't beat up on myself. But I am committed to moving in a direction where I feel a little bit of inspiration. I'm committed to moving in a direction where something calls to me, where I see something that is possible for my life that's a step beyond where I'm at right now. And I get that to move in that direction, I'm going to have to do something. I'm going to have to take some actions that are consistent with that movement. And then, you know how you know what those actions are? They're the ones that call to you. They're the ones that you feel good about. They're not the ones you think you should do. And you say to yourself, well, you know, I do feel a little inspired about the food. I mean, my brain might be telling me what I need to do is go start exercising, but I kind of don't want to. But I do feel a little inspired to start cooking and, you know, maybe making some salads. Maybe it's as simple as that. Maybe you make the two salad dressings, which are really yummy, that I sent out recipes for, and you cut up vegetables. You just cut up bell peppers, and you cut up cucumbers, and you cut up carrots, and you cut up lettuce, and you wash it twice a week. So you have a couple pre-made salads, and your transformational change for the next 2 weeks is that you make five salads. And you do the preparation on Sunday, and then through the week, you just make yourself salads. And maybe that's what you take on. But what will have it work for you is how you relate to it. Relate to it like your braces. Relate to it like a subtle force that's going to exert consistent pressure in your life to take you towards a goal that means something to you. So that's how we want to apply the previous 4 weeks. We're not looking for radical, massive change on the scale or massive change in the mirror. We're looking for something that feels a little bit good to you, that you want to take on, and you want to take it on and build it into a habit that you enjoy, because it's enjoying that habit that's going to keep that habit consistent. Breathing, training yourself to do breathing properly, great habit to build. Meditation, super habit to build. The meditation that I posted that's on the course website right now, it's just one form of so many different kinds of meditations. There are a million meditations out there in the world. There's breath meditation, there's visual meditation, there's, you know, subtle body meditations. I mean, if you like the idea of meditation and you don't like the one that I sent out, I love it. I think it's a great beginner meditation. Search around. One great resource is a CD by a woman named Kim Eng, Kim E-N-G, called Meditations for a New Earth. And there's like 10 different types of meditations. And she has walking meditations, like a meditation you do while walking. And find one that you like. Great practice to take on. But the key is take on what you're inspired to do. Look at it like braces. So with that said, and with this idea established that what we want to do right now is we want to look at this picture of meds, mind state, exercise, diet, sleep. You want to take on the exact amount of practices that you're inspired to take on. And I also don't want to talk you down from doing more. If you feel good about improving your diet, taking on exercise, adopting a meditation practice, and getting to bed earlier and starting to take fish oil, if that feels good to you, if that feels like a breakthrough, do it. You're not going to hurt yourself by taking all that on. The critical thing is no shoulding yourself and no pressure. No shoulding yourself. Should is like a four-letter word. Don't do it to yourself. Should is an awful mentality to be in. Should says that my desires and my inspirations and my motivations at this moment are bad and wrong. And basically at the level of my being, there's something flawed, and if I were different, things would be better. Terrible way to think. You are where you are. With that in mind, with our mind state, exercise, diet, sleep perspective in mind, and with the idea that we want to, right now, step back and pick out the things that are calling to us and adapt those into life as consistent practices with the goal of creating consistency, what I want to do is take a further step back and now look at the content that I've presented to you guys in a broader overview and contextualize it in a way that I truly find deeply, deeply inspiring, and that I hope will let you find a deeper, I wouldn't even call it motivation, I'd call it inspiration. Motivation is like you're driven to get to a goal. Inspiration is the goal is like whatever. You're enjoying the moment. Like you're present and you're just fired up. I hope this perspective gets you there. And then the content that we'll be discussing in 6, 7, 8, and 9, which is a little bit more specific, can fit inside of the context of this perspective. So I talked with you guys in class 1 about this really interesting idea that you can travel all over the globe and there are healthy people who are pre-modern. You can look and you can find hunter-gatherers and you can find Stone Age farmers who live longer than we do in the West. And they don't have modern medicine, and there's no electricity, and there's no running water, and yet they have these long average lifespans, and they're free of most of our chronic diseases. And that's really cool. And I think it's something that should make us step back and take notice and think about how we live our lives. Well, tonight I want to frame this in the context of human history. What this is really going to be about is the question, who are we? Who are we as individuals? Who are we as a culture here in America? Who are we as human beings? What does it mean to be human? And then how do we live best? Because that's what this class is really about. How do we live best? It's this fundamental question. To get to that question, we've got to look at our history. We've got to look at our origins. So if you look at human beings, and we can look from the lens of either creationism or evolutionary biology, one thing is certain. We have a multi-thousand-year history of existence. And it's clear that we have design. As beings, we have design. So if you'll rewind the clock with me to, say, 20,000 years ago, what things looked like for Homo sapiens, for human beings, is there was no agriculture, and human beings all over the earth lived in very small communities. We lived as hunter-gatherers in small communities. In fact, it's believed that there were really no communities larger than about 400 people. And what the rhythm of our days looked like is you'd wake up with the sun, you'd go out, you'd gather some nuts, maybe you'd catch some fish for hunter-gatherer communities that live near the water. There was a limited level of hunting. Most of the food actually came from female gathering activities. It's an interesting one. So even in hunting-oriented communities, hunting provided about 20% of the calories. Most of the calories came from nuts and vegetables and fruits and things that women found. And communities were intensely social. There was plenty of dancing and singing. There were fires at night most of the time. There was a fair amount of celebration. And another thing that's interesting is if you look at a lot of hunter-gatherer cultures, they were able to take care of their food needs in usually 3 or 4 hours of work a day. And then there was some stuff building shelter, but there was actually a lot of time for recreation. So also contrary to a lot of popular belief, life wasn't that stressful and hard for many hunter-gatherer cultures. Well, one thing that's fascinating for us to think about, standing in our modern civilization, you know, here we are, all of us are on computers or phones, and we're sitting inside of rooms, and we look out and we see walls, and there's electric lights, and we see cars, and pavement, and telephone poles, and all this other crazy stuff. Well, of course, none of that existed. But what's cooler than the fact that that didn't exist is think about how these human beings back then thought about their lives versus how we today think about our lives. Some things were the same. Family was important. Community was important. Social status was important. People really cared about what other people thought and making sure you had a good reputation and making sure you kind of, you know, were ahead of the class. Security was important. It was important to have shelter and to build quality tools and to do the things that were necessary to take care of your material provision. But one thing that's so fascinating about their culture is they lived in a state of total dependence on nature, and they were completely at the mercy of nature. And that was just reality for them. You know, if it didn't rain for a while, they didn't get water. If the animals that they hunted weren't in season, they didn't eat those animals. If the fruits didn't grow, they didn't get fruit. And so human beings lived with this, there was no possible alternative. Nature provided or it didn't. And then the great movement away from that began with technology. It began when human beings first started to domesticate animals mostly and domesticate food crops. We began to learn how to grow grains. And the human paradigm on planet Earth shifted from, we're just dependent on the way that nature goes, to, oh my God, we can control nature. We can build fields, and we can irrigate those fields, and we can store grains in warehouses. And it was this movement to agriculture that created the seeds for all of civilization, all of civilization. In essence, the ability to store grains represented wealth. That was kind of, in some ways, the first money. And then people were able to concentrate big storehouses of wheat or millet or other things like that, and then say to other people, look, I've got all this wheat, so maybe you can go, you know, make shoes, and I'll give you wheat. Or maybe you can go, you know, build stuff and get good at building stuff, and I'll give you wheat. And division of labor began, and modern economics began to set in. And these were concepts back then. I mean, they weren't state of life. People didn't have professions 14,000 years ago. Everyone was a hunter-gatherer. Everyone just did what they did for the most part. But then we began to specialize. And, you know, if you believe in evolution, or even if you believe in intelligent design, for about 100,000 years, human beings have been living as hunter-gatherers in harmony with nature. Agriculture bursts on the scene, and all of a sudden there's all these changes. So agriculture happened about 13,000 years ago. And for around 10,000 years, you had this slow movement of humanity away from nature and into a more kind of urban, civilized lifestyle. You had streets built and cities built and buildings built, and people took on professions and started to work indoors and these things that had never existed before. And then you get to around 3,000 years ago, and the pace of progress really starts to accelerate. Cities start to come together. You have the foundations for Greece and the foundations for Rome, and in the Middle East, you know, a little later, civilization starts to surge forward. But the entire paradigm of human existence starts to change. You're not in nature anymore. Now you're in society. You're in a culture. You're in a built environment where everything's been made by human hands. And you're not dependent on nature to thrive. You're dependent on making it in this human-made artificial environment, impressing the people next door, maybe getting the right kind of job. God forbid you live in a caste system like in India. Well, then you're just hoping the people with power don't kill you. But the fact of the matter is, the whole way that we lived transformed. And as civilization and society continued to, quote-unquote, progress, we became progressively more divorced from the way that our ancestors had lived forever. Technology continues to move. We have, you know, sanitation and indoor plumbing, and we have the Industrial Revolution. We have heating systems. Eventually, we have electric lights. And more and more and more, the background idea that runs human existence, the thought that's at the core of our civilization, the thought that's at the core of our identity, what we really think in our heads is that my quality of life, my making it in the world, what my life is really all about, has to do with things like the progress of science and technology, my social status relative to kind of like money and what I do for a living, my connections, what my home looks like, what my car looks like, what kind of computers I can afford, my Blackberries, my health insurance, this stuff that what college I get into, what college my kids get into, where we go to university. Our lives have become about these evaluations and these categories and these areas of focus that we forget are very modern, completely artificial in the sense that they were created by human beings, and which our ancestors throughout the vast majority of our species history never thought about because none of it existed. Well, what's the relevance of this? What's the point? Why am I introducing this at the midway point of our class? Why am I asking us to step back and look at our lives through this lens? the background ideas that we use to define our lives determine our quality of life. They're subtle. They're also like braces. They're there. You don't think about them most of the time, and they're exerting pressure. They're exerting pull. They're exerting psychological force, and that's what culture is. Culture is all the background ideas that all of us agree are the truth that none of us think about. That would be my definition of our culture. So it's really funny. Like in our culture, right, we would say something like, well, you know, you just don't go to a party wearing that. I mean, everyone knows that. What? Where did that come from? In 1864 in England, it was different. This isn't a fundamental truth. It's not written into the fabric of the universe. It's not like gravity that, like, you know, you don't show up wearing blue velvet cling pants to a formal party. But to us, this stuff is like the truth. It's like an absolute truth. You'd be mortified if you did this. You'd be mortified if your friend did it. Wow, that's culture. It's the truth that we just accept. At an even deeper level, there's the stuff we don't even think about. Like, it matters where you go to college, and making money is really what life's about, and all this other stuff. Very, very funny. And tonight's not a lecture on philosophy. It's a talk about health and wellness. And here's the relevance. At some point in that progress of history that I just described, what I would call the fundamental paradigm or the background idea or the basic principle of human life changed. The basic principle of human life prior to the dawn of agriculture, throughout the vast majority of human history, was to make it, you have to adapt to the natural world. You have to, you know, nature, it is the way it is. And you got to learn how to hunt, and you got to learn how to gather, and, you know, you don't have to question that stuff. You kind of live at the mercy of nature. And you figure out how to live in harmony with nature. You don't fight it. Well, technology changed the paradigm. And we started to say to ourselves, no, we can master nature. We can grow the food. We can build the buildings. We can heat the buildings. We don't need the sun. We can build electric lights. We don't even necessarily need to worry about how we live our lives, because the way that we'll keep our bodies healthy is surgery and medicine and more technology. And then you look at the richest, most advanced nation on Earth, and how has all of that worked out? We are the apogee of the dominant paradigm of the last 13,000 years. America in the year 2011 is the full flowering of where humanity has been headed for over 10,000 years, a progressively more technology, industry, and economics-driven paradigm, basic idea, culture, with the thought being that this is what will make us happy. This is what will fulfill us. This is the purpose of life. This is what will make us healthy. And look at us. We're one of the least healthy first world nations. We're one of the least happy first world nations. And people living with no material wealth whatsoever across the entire globe live longer than we do, don't suffer from the devastating chronic diseases that are so prevalent in our culture. It's stunning that we accept this. And they're happier than we are, too, by virtually every survey that gets done. Wow. What went wrong? What went wrong? We lost sight of something simple. We lost sight of our absolute dependence on nature, our absolute dependence. Our design hasn't changed. We are still the same beings that we were 14, 15, 16,000 years ago. We're the same beings, same cells, same DNA. Same brains, same consciousness, and same soul, if you believe in a soul. Certainly same mind, if you don't believe in a soul. None of that's changed. And we've built this world that's not a match to what we are. There's nothing inherently wrong with this world. There's nothing inherently bad about an office job or a bag of Doritos or a Twinkie or even a cigarette. These things aren't inherently bad. But the reason that they present challenges to our well-being is because we have this sophisticated and beautiful and intricate and phenomenally adapted design. And if you are someone who just believes in evolution, then it was the evolutionary process, it was that algorithm, it was what is sometimes called the blind watchmaker that created this 100 trillion cell symphony that is the body, that created a supercomputer in the form of the human brain that's more sophisticated than maybe the entire internet in many ways. But that system is so beautiful and so perfect. And the genius of its design is in its adaptation to the environment for which it was designed. And we've radically altered that environment, and we've dramatically transformed the way that we live, and as a result, all of this wiring, all of this structure, all that we are, isn't working the way that it's supposed to work. So what's the answer? It's not going back. One, it's unrealistic. Two, it's undesirable. I'm not arguing for a sort of return to earth, grassrootsy, you know, let's give up iPods and laptops and office jobs. Never going to happen. But we've got to get back in touch with this concept of our total dependence on harmony with our design, on harmony with nature. That's, I believe, the next great cultural revolution. I think it's where we're headed. It's inevitable. Because we're staring in the face right now the progressively obvious failure of more technology and more money to meaningfully affect human happiness. It's getting to be pretty obvious that it's not working. And at some point, we're going to stop thinking that the next great discovery or the next great economic explosion or more of something is going to make a difference. We're going to get that as a culture at some point. But as individuals right now, we can face this and we can wake up. And we can realize that our well-being and our happiness is dependent, totally dependent, fundamentally dependent, and unalterably dependent on living in harmony with the way that we're built. And then the key is just doing it. And it is simple. And the barrier is only in the mind. It's only in the mind. The barrier is our habits. It's our emotions. It's our sense that so much of our culture, so much of society isn't on board with this, and as a result, it takes a little something extra for each of us to do it. But I think when you start to get the scope of this and you start to understand it, it creates a little inspiration. It starts to feel like you're part of something. Because the real truth of the matter is, this is the way that shifts in society start. There is a way of living that would radically alter America. And it would do more than just increase our health and our well-being. Because the fact of the matter is, when you thrive, you don't damage the world. The happier you are, the more well you are, the more centered you are, and especially as you begin to grasp the dependence of your health and happiness on nature, you become a less dangerous human being. Your whole thoughts about things like environmental policy and pollution and human rights, all of it changes. So this is actually about more than you, which is the part that I find so inspiring. When we choose to live this way, if this is a message that appeals to you, if this is something that makes sense to you, you take this on and you incorporate it into your life, and you'll slowly start to thrive, slowly. And you'll look like you thrive. And you'll have more energy. And you'll be a little more vital. And you'll be a little more vibrant. And stuff about you will start to change, and it will impact people around you. And they'll start to notice, and they'll take it on too. And that's where my inspiration comes from. That's how I do this. Because at the end of the day, the fact of the matter is, you know, it's funny, I got into all this stuff because my habits, left their own devices, are a disaster. I like Ben and Jerry's and cookies and TV and, man, oh, man, I could be a really lazy, happy, modern technology junkie, except for the fact that it tore my body and my mind apart, and I had to do this stuff. But the real inspiration to change, to take on those little practices and gradually begin to move my teeth, you know, gradually begin to transform my life, and it took me some time. It came when I started to realize that I was standing for something beyond myself. And the simple way of expressing this is that whatever you're up to in life, whatever your priorities are, your work, a vision you have, a nonprofit you want to start, your job, whatever it is, ultimately, your power, your success in these endeavors, it's built on the foundation of your personal well-being, your clarity, your energy, your vitality. And that is a consequence of your harmony with nature. It really is. It's inescapable. Well, then the funny thing is, whatever you're up to, being a mom, doing a better job, being a teacher, what you want to do is you want to give something to someone else. You want to make a difference in another person's life. You have so much to offer that's outside the scope of this course, and that's what you do. But you can also offer this example. And America needs this so badly. We are a sick and unhealthy country, and we are struggling. We're struggling. And really, really good people in every walk of life, in politics and in business and in the media, celebrities all over the world, we just see so much struggle with disease, with depression, with an inability to control stress, with behavior that we morally condemn, like cheating and drug use and alcoholism and lies and all that. But where do you think that stuff comes from? It comes from really unwell people. I mean, the worse you feel, I'm not excusing it morally, but it is the case that the worse you feel, the more likely you are to do things that are bad for yourself and others. So I think there's a real legacy with all of this. And this is the last time we're going to talk about this stuff in the course. After this, we go back to practical. But this is my invitation to think about the fact that your life touches people and that what you're up to can be very powerful and that it fundamentally depends on you thriving and that your thriving is impossible without harmony with these various dimensions of yourself. So with that in mind, what I encourage for these next 2 weeks, we're off next week, I encourage you to think back, take 10 minutes, or if you're inspired, actually go back and review the notes and maybe listen to a couple lectures, and pull out the practices that are calling to you now, the ones that you feel good about, as many or as few as you feel good about, and put them into place in your life in a way where you're really going to do them for the next 4 to 6 weeks and start to notice the subtle difference that it makes. Start to notice that you feel a little better, have a little more energy, a little more engaged, something. And then know, remind yourself, because at some point you're going to want to go back to old habits. You're going to find some excuse or find some reason because you're human. Remind yourself that what you're up to, one, is about the slow and steady application of powerful processes over time that will in time move your molars, that will in time change your body. It'll change your gene expression. It'll change your biochemistry. It'll rebuild you. It will, and consistency is the access. And then beyond that, remind yourself that you're doing it not just about you. It's not just about you. It's about what you care about. It's a way of moving in the direction you want to move in your life. So with that, I am going to wrap up tonight. I am happy to tackle any questions for a few more minutes. There are going to be no notes for this class. There's no homework. We're going to get back to all that stuff in our next session. The homework is just this. It's think about what we've talked about thus far and take on what moves you. So that's a wrap for me. Is there anything you guys would like to talk about?
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. I had the phone on mute.
Yes.
Okay, so with actually eating like a caveman,
okay.
I have a question in regards to, I know that it's best to eat a lot of raw fruits and vegetables and things, but say I were to make a vegetable soup.
Okay.
I know most people, when they make soup, they cook their vegetables till they're very tender.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any nutrition left in the vegetables or the broth when you cook it like that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And actually, it's wonderful for you to make those kinds of soups. So there's lots of different kinds of nutrition in vegetables. And the kind of nutrition that you get from raw vegetables or very lightly cooked vegetables, you get the enzymes, the actual plant enzymes, which are the chemicals that help the plant live its life. But those enzymes have biological activity in our bodies, and they're very helpful. You also get a lot of what's called the phytonutrition, which is like the antioxidants mostly. And that stuff is best consumed from fresh or lightly cooked vegetables. But vegetables also contain a lot of healthy minerals. They contain other vitamins that aren't damaged through the cooking process. And when you cook those vegetables for a very long time, it makes some of that stuff more bioavailable. it actually becomes more useful to the body. So stews that you simmer for, you know, 30 minutes, an hour, you actually are concentrating some vitamins and minerals, and they're being absorbed into that liquid, and they are being transformed by that cooking process in ways where they become deeply nourishing to you. So it's wonderful to eat a combination of really well-cooked vegetables in the form of stews and fresh vegetables. And one thing that's really interesting, actually, is that if you cook high-quality meats with these stews, if you're not a vegetarian, it's a similar situation. They actually deliver this fabulous nutrition. There's a wonderful book by a woman named Sally Fallon called Nourishing Traditions. It's a cookbook, and it's based on the research of Weston Price, which looked at how hunter-gatherers eat. And in many ways, it's like the landmark text of nutritional anthropology. And one thing Sally Fallon points out is that you have so many pre-modern cultures that have this tradition of like these, you know, really like simmered stews that are just kind of there simmering forever. They've got like the meat in there and even the bones in there, and they got the vegetables. And that this stuff is super nutrient dense. And what's interesting is there's nutrition in it that science hasn't really characterized yet. So Dr. Price and many people since him, they actually believe that these other vitamins that we haven't figured out yet. Price called it vitamin P and his activator X complex, which was like, you know, weird jargon from the middle of the 20th century that sounded sciencey back then. But no one really understands fully what this stuff delivers, but we're sure it's really good for you. So making soups and making stews and things like that, it's fabulous. And you are going to break certain nutrients down with the aggressive cooking of the vegetables, but as long as you're also eating fresh and frozen vegetables that are minimally cooked or eaten raw, you're going to get enough of that stuff. You're going to make other nutrients more bioavailable. So it's a great thing to do. And then, of course, the fiber and the way in which the soups will fill you is super, super valuable because they're going to help you not eat other junky stuff. And you're going to enjoy them, which is also super valuable.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, fascinating stuff.
And what about, like, with meat also, if you overcook the meat, is that bad for you?
It depends how you overcook it. You definitely don't want to char meat.
Okay.
So whenever you're getting that blackness on meat, if it's more than just a little bit, it's not good for you. Like a little bit is okay, but you don't really want to sear meat too much.
So,
and you don't want any kind of crustiness flaking off the meat.
Is it better to cook meat? I mean, some recipes call to cook it at 250 for a couple hours, but then other recipes call for cook it at 400 for 10 minutes.
Yeah, it depends on the type of meat.
Difference?
So with poultry, the thing with poultry, with chicken and turkey, you want it to cook all the way through and you want the color to change. And as long as the color's changed, you've killed the bacteria. And then in terms of, and this is my opinion, this is not well-documented science. There's lots of different philosophies on this. I think you don't want to cook the living hell out of it. You want the color to change, but you want it to still be moist from a nutritional perspective. Now, with red meat, we know that it's more nutritious when it's minimally cooked. So with your steak and your lamb, medium rare is the most nutritious way to eat the meat.
Okay. So.
And the same thing is true with fish, like with salmon. The best thing to do is to sear it on the outside, but not to really blacken it. So you want a sear, but you don't want crustiness. Like you don't want, it doesn't taste good anyway. You don't want well done. You don't want like, you know, flakes falling off because then it's going to be carcinogenic. So you want to blacken the outside and you want to leave the middle pretty tender and pretty raw. There's great nutrition in raw meats. The fat, it probably has to do with the fats. The fats in healthy cuts of meat, like grass-fed meats, and the fats in wild-cut fish are super, super healthy. And omega-3 fats especially are very heat-sensitive. So the odds are that as we overcook these, we're destroying the omega-3 fats. And there's also a lot of vitamins in meats, vitamin A, vitamin D, the fat-soluble vitamins. And it's probable that those are deactivated by high levels of heat. So it's good to eat your red meats and your fish medium rare. With poultry, the amino acid profiles in poultry, you know, amino acids aren't really messed up by heating, mostly just protein, and poultry is mostly just protein, so I don't think it matters as much. In terms of high heat versus lower heat for nutrition, as a general rule, I would side with lower heat.
Okay.
I think when you really start to heat stuff up a lot, you know, you do create molecular changes in the food, but that, again, is not scientific. That's more instinctual on my part.
But like using a crock pot and putting beef in there and then cooking it for, you know, 6 hours on low, is that completely making the meat not healthy?
Well, it's interesting.
Beneficial?
It's not going to make it unhealthy. It's not going to become bad for you. As with the vegetables, there are some aspects of nutrition that are going to be healthier with more lightly done meat. There are other aspects where it's actually going to be better for you when it's heavily cooked. So similarly, some of the minerals in meat, they become highly solubilized in the fat with long-term cooking, and you actually are then able to absorb them better. And fat-soluble vitamins in vegetables, when you cook meat and vegetables together in a crock pot for 6 hours, there are certain vitamins and certain minerals in the vegetables that are actually going to go and bind up with the fat from the meat and become very, very bioavailable. So it's very good for you. Mm. You're never going to go wrong making soups and stews. Soups and stews are great sources of nutrition. They're different from eating less cooked food.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah.
Very, very good information.
Oh, thank you.
Go ahead.
The last thing is, if you have any recipes for, like, how to make, what to put on salmon or tuna or something like that, because I bought some salmon at Sam's Club, and, you know, it's wild and everything, but it has its breadcrumbs and all this other stuff in there that I would prefer not to be eating, and I just not really sure how to cook it.
Okay. Well, so, I can definitely shoot something out.
Suggestion.
One thing that's super easy that I like a lot with salmon is put olive oil in a pan and
mm-hmm.
heat it just below the smoke point. So put it on, say, medium heat, but you don't want the oil to be smoking. And just cover the salmon in lemon pepper, like fresh ground lemon pepper, and really cover it in the lemon pepper. Like coat it. And then you just put it down in that hot oil for about a minute and a half per side, maybe 2 minutes tops. And the outside will get that very subtle sear, and the inside will stay mostly raw, and it's really delicious, and it couldn't be more simple. You can also add dill to that, and it's very tasty. You can do it with lemon pepper and dill.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, sure thing.
You had said, of course, you know, alcohol or drugs or anything like that to an extreme, you know, we know we're not talking about that. But I've been hearing a lot of things, and actually tonight on the TV they're talking about red wine being good for you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure in a minimal usage, you know. And I was just wondering about that. I mean, is that true or is that just somebody saying that who's selling red wine?
Yeah, there is actually a lot of good evidence that red wine is good for people. And I find it persuasive. I find it persuasive for a couple of reasons. One, it's been very broadly confirmed, and there's never been anyone who's refuted it. So there's very consistent science. This isn't one of those, like, one lab says, and then the other lab says. So it seems to help with heart disease especially. That's pretty much unequivocal, that a glass of red wine, about a 5-ounce glass of red wine every day on average, seems to help prevent heart disease. And the actual alcohol seems to have a positive effect. But there are also other specific chemicals in the red wine. And resveratrol, if you've heard of resveratrol, has been very well studied and well highlighted in red wine. What resveratrol is it's a chemical that activates the anti-aging cascade inside of our cells. It's what's called a sirtuinin-activating chemical, or an SAC. And sirtuinins seem to be a part of the body's natural response to fasting that protects cells and prevents aging. But there are certain chemicals, resveratrol being one of them, that activates these sirtuinins and theoretically can extend life. So red wine is a great way to get these. You know, cultures that drink red wine tend to be pretty healthy. And the other thing that I find persuasive beyond the science is that human beings have been drinking wine for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years, which tends to argue for the idea that our bodies have adapted to it reasonably well. It's just been around forever. So I think red wine is helpful for most people. I think a glass a night is great. I think it's a far better stress reducer and sort of like, you know, go-to comfort food or go-to treat than junk food. So I feel like many people kind of come home when they're stressed out and they want to eat something to comfort themselves in front of the TV or something at night, and you're much better off with the red wine than with a bag of chips or with chocolate. You know, it's actually going to deliver some benefits. And the other cool thing about red wine is it doesn't really destabilize your blood sugar, so it doesn't tend to cause you to overeat. So I'm a fan of the one glass of red wine a day. You know, I think it's great. I don't do it that way. I probably consume 3 or 4 glasses of wine a week, and I don't drink wine every night. But I'll have a glass or two with dinner one night and maybe a glass or two with dinner another night, and I think it's good for you. I think it's good stuff.
Is there any other wines or alcohol or beer or anything that...
Vodka is the purest alcohol, and it's the lowest calorie, and it's the lowest carb. So if you're going to do any form of liquor, vodka is the way to go. And the best way to drink it is either in vodka soda with a twist of lime, very simple, very pure drink, or vodka martinis. After vodka, scotch whiskey, not bourbon, is one of the lowest calorie, lowest carb alcohols. So I think that I think red wine and vodka are the two healthiest. After that, I would put scotch whiskey and white wine as the next two. And once you get beyond those four, and champagne would fall in the same category, once you get beyond those four, I don't really think any alcohol is good for you. I think the rest of the liquors are not good. And beer is just one of the most damaging and toxic substances you can put in your body. Beer is just awful for you.
Why is that?
Well, non-light beers contain a sugar called maltodextrin, and that's where beer gets a lot of its calories from. And maltodextrin is the highest glycemic sugar, I think, that's known to science, meaning that it elevates blood sugar faster than any other sugar. And when blood sugar goes up very quickly, it causes fat storage and it causes cortisol release, which causes adrenal fatigue and causes abdominal fat deposition. So the whole idea of like the beer belly or the beer gut is very real. The sugar in beer drives the human body to store fat. Another thing about beer is it's very nourishing to yeast, and millions and millions of people have very subtle yeast overgrowth problems in their body. So you're actually exacerbating a chronic infection that is incredibly common in our culture when you're drinking beer. And it's just kind of nutritionally devoid. I mean, it's got some B vitamins in it. The other thing is beers tend to be pretty chemically debauched. I mean, a lot of them, they're mass-produced, especially the lagers. They're mass-produced, and they just go through a lot of processing. And whenever you're processing anything, you're destroying the nutrition and you're introducing artificial elements. So I like the taste of beer, but I almost never drink it because there's just too many negatives in terms of its impact on the body.
Okay.
Guinness, actually, interestingly, is one of the healthiest beers. Guinness is reasonably low carb and reasonably low calorie, and it's not too impure, and it's actually relatively vitamin rich. So if I drink beer, I drink Guinness, because I like it, but also because it's one of the least unhealthy.
Okay. They are having something tonight, though. I've seen that on the news about red wine. They're supposed to be having something on about that.
Yeah, the red wine stuff is legitimate. It's not just people trying to publish that red wine is good for you because it gets media attention. You know, sometimes that happens. Like, there's a lot of stuff that I believe comes out kind of because people want to get stuff in the news, or there's economic interest behind it, and it's not legitimate. But I think the science behind red wine is pretty good.
I mean, I don't drink every day, but when I do socially drink, which is, you know, like I said, like you said, a couple times a week or something, have a couple drinks. I was just trying to look for something that would be the better choice.
Yeah. Well, red wine and vodka are your two best bets. And then after that, white wine and Scotch whiskey. Or Irish whiskey. I'm not discriminating based on nation. It's just that bourbons, like Jack Daniels and stuff, are pretty sugary.
Does red wine prohibit or does it accelerate yeast growth if you have a yeast problem?
Only very, very subtly, not the way that beer does. There is a little bit of sugar in red wine, and so yeast can potentially respond to those sugars, but it's very subtle. The biggest concern with red wine is actually the sulfites. Sulfites are preservatives that are used in red wines, and sometimes people get headaches from the sulfites, and actually a lot of hangovers when people do drink wines are from the sulfites, not from the actual red wine. So if you find that you have adverse reactions to red wines, you want to find a sulfite-free red wine. And most good liquor stores these days will carry that. And if you ask, they'll know what you're talking about. And also, if you know anyone who makes their own wine, it'll be sulfite-free, probably. And if you like red wines,
very interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. And if you like your own wines, you can make your own red wines. You can actually get a bunch of friends. It's easy to do if you Google this and find something around you. You can find these local various places. Sometimes they're wine sales shops. Sometimes they specialize in this. And if you get a bunch of friends together, you pay like $300, you know, $50 each. And then you can make 50 bottles of wine. And you get the wines in it. And there's
parents did that.
Huh.
And you
actually get to
smash
your own grapes with your feet.
You can get organic grapes, and you can make sure there's no preservatives, and make your own wine.
Because I love red wine.
Yeah, I think red wine.
I only drink it like once a month, and yes, sometimes I will get a massive headache, and I'm always trying different things, but maybe that's why. Because
look for a sulfite-free red wine.
Yeah. Oh.
Might make the difference.
I just learned all kinds of stuff tonight.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Okay. Anything else you guys want to talk about?
Nope. I'm good.
No.
Awesome. Well, thank you for being on the call, and good night to you too, and good night to everybody who is listening from afar. And as always, you can email info@vaughngray.com with any questions. None of you ever do this. Please take me up on it. If you think of something, email in a question, okay?
Okay.
So that's it for tonight, and thanks so much.
Good night.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
Good night.